This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. This is also an exciting time to be an astrophysicist with the powerful Webb telescope sending back breathtaking images from the far reaches of the universe. Our guest, astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, has been expanding our understanding of stars and space as the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, the author of a number of popular books, and the host of the podcast Star Talk. Stephen Colbert said Tyson was his favorite guest. Here they are, right after the 2016 presidential election, when Tyson made a case for something called the cosmic perspective, quoting an Apollo 14 astronaut to help put earthly political events in context.
You develop an instant global consciousness, a people orientation, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world, and a compulsion to do something about it. From out there on the moon, international politics looks so petty. You want to grab a politician by the scruff of the neck and drag him a quarter million miles away and say, "Look at that, you son of a b-." That is Edgar Mitchell, Apollo 14 astronaut. That is the cosmic perspective.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson has a new book, and it's titled Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization, where he makes a case for the value of education, for rational thought and evidence to help us through these turbulent times. Neil deGrasse Tyson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks. It's been too long. We should do this more often.
We should do this more often. You're absolutely right about that. Well, let me begin with a big question for you. Why are science and evidence and facts and knowledge and truth under such attack these days?
Yeah, I don't know that I have the secret answer to that. But I can tell you that the internet, social media, the internet broadly, maybe social media specifically, but the internet broadly gives people the false sense of expertise when they spend 1 hour researching a subject and then they combat someone who might have spent 8 years becoming an expert in that field. And you'll say, well, I read 5 wiki pages and went to 3 websites and I know what I'm talking about. And so I think what we're missing is a sense of internet maturity. I don't know that it's taught in school yet. A sense of a self-awareness of when you know something and when you don't. And that's what's missing. I'm not going to say get rid of the internet. I'm going to say the internet is still in its infancy.
Sure.
I mean, come on now. A couple of decades old. You know, it was centuries before anyone figured with the movable type printing press of Gutenberg that maybe you could put news on it and then make broadsheets and then communicate news. That was like somebody had to like invent that, right? And it wasn't the first thought at the time. And same when movies were invented. The first thought people had were, well, let's film a play, all right? And then it took some maturity to figure out you can do other things with it that are productive or for the greater good. So I have some blind hope that the internet,
we'll take it.
That we will mature around the internet so that we will have a more balanced sense of what we know and what we don't.
So would that be a kind of a combination of both skepticism and curiosity? That's how we should approach things that we may not know or may not understand?
Yeah, you just said in that one sentence was which I was trying to say for 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
You want to do this? You can speak for me in this.
No,
interview.
I can't.
So that's exactly right. There are people who think a skeptic is someone who doubts everything. No. A skeptic is someone who initially you say, well, what is the evidence in support of what it is you're saying? And then you explore that evidence, you evaluate the evidence, and then you come to a conclusion. And what should be happening and isn't is that you apportion your confidence in whether something is right according to the level of evidence that supports it. And part of the problem is not just internet maturity, but in the school system, we're still taught science as a satchel of facts. And while satchels of facts exist within science, and they're an important component, especially in some branches relative to others, I can tell you that what science is, most importantly, is a way of querying nature. And it's also a way to protect you from thinking something is true that is not, or that something is not true that is. And the methods and tools of science are exquisitely tuned to empower you in this way. And that's not taught, as far as I can tell. You look at the science textbooks, there's the bold-faced vocabulary words throughout the chapter, and then you memorize those, they test you, you take the test and you move on. And nowhere do you pause and say, what is this enterprise? What is the engine of this enterprise, and how does it work? How and why does it work? And with that kind of awareness coming out of school, you would never have people declaring Earth is flat. You would never have people, whole political factions, in denial of climate change. That just wouldn't be the case. You might have a different political solution to climate change than someone else, but you don't debate the climate change. This is established as an objective truth with the methods and tools of science. So I think it goes deeper, farther back than what we're dealing with now. And maybe the next generation will have this figured out.
Well, let me ask you about the title of your book, which is a translation of Galileo's treatise that he wrote back in 1610, well before we were born. But essentially, he was talking about the fact that the Earth is not the center of the universe, the center of the cosmos, that the Earth revolves around the sun. What did the Catholic Church do in response to that discovery? Is to basically brand him a heretic. He was under house arrest. It took something like 300 years for the church to actually clear his name. Isn't this what humans do when they confront something that they think they don't believe in or they don't understand?
Yep. Especially when that belief system is encoded and embedded in an entire sort of branch of civilization. In that case, it was the Catholic Church. To the Catholic Church's credit, they've been around a long time, so maybe 300 years is small compared to their history, maybe. So they did come around and forgive Galileo for speaking the truth. So what I fear is a world where the truth is somehow resisted simply because it conflicts with people's personal beliefs. It could be their religious beliefs, their cultural beliefs, their political beliefs, their family beliefs. And again, that's a missing link in the educational system, because when a science establishes an objective truth, it is true whether or not you believe in it. And getting back to Galileo's book, he wrote this book in 1610. It was called Sidereus Nuncius. And in it, he reported his first observations, telescopic observations of the night sky. And he showed that the moon had mountains and valleys and hills and craters. It was blemished. It was not a smooth sphere as imagined by his contemporaries. The sun had spots, okay, acne, if you will. That was a little freaky too. And to show that Earth and other planets orbited the sun and not all these other things orbiting Earth, it fell right in the face of established canon in civilization. And so Sidereus Nuncius, translated from the Latin, is starry messenger. It's that you can learn from the universe things that affect how you think about who you are and what your relationship is to other people and things on Earth. It's not obvious that that should be the case when you think about it. We're here on Earth. What does the universe know? All right. So I empathize with people who initially might have discounted that you could get wisdom from the universe that can inform your ways here on Earth. And so I borrowed the title Starry Messenger because now each of the chapters in the book has foundational reference to science and how science thinks about those kinds of problems. And then I jump into your life and all the flashpoints that have caused fights, especially around the Thanksgiving table.
Well, and we will get to all that, but let me segue from Galileo to the Webb telescope. We did a show about this over the summer when those images were coming back. And as an astrophysicist, talk about finding our place in the universe. We're nothing in the universe.
Yeah, that's one of the first cosmic perspectives. You got, it's like, deal with it, all right? But there's some very uplifting things there as well. It's not simply that we are small and the universe is large. It's that we learned, this happened mid-20th century, by the way, we learned that the atoms in our body are traceable to stars that manufactured those atoms, scattered across the galaxy, and they then exploded, enriching the next generation of gas clouds with the very elements of life. And so the idea that we're small, it's true, in time and in space and in every practical way that we had would otherwise value, but then you realize, you look up and say, yeah, I'm small, but I and those stars have common origin. We're not just poetically stardust. We are literally stardust. And I'm not just alive in this universe. Yes, that's true. But the universe, in a way, is alive within me. And that's for me, that's a profound insight, a gift of modern astrophysics to civilization that borders on the spiritual. And with the James Webb Space Telescope taking it up a notch from the Hubble, oh my gosh, with the level of detail, the universe becomes ever closer to us. It becomes basically our backyard, where you say, okay, Mom, Dad, I'm going to go out and play in the backyard, and the backyard is right there, the galaxies, the gas clouds, the stars being born.
Well, and I, as a non-scientist, I still love the idea that when you look up into the sky, now, of course, with Webb, we can go deeper and deeper. We are looking back at time. I mean, that we are looking, you know, I'm talking to an astrophysicist, you know, you knew this well before my discovery of it. But nonetheless, that we are looking back at time, and it is such a reassuring thing. We got about a minute before our first break here.
Oh, just real quick. So, so telescopes are, in a way, time machines. Right. They, because it takes light time to reach us, the farther away the object is, the farther back in time you see it. So you see it not as it is, but as it once was. And this is going on all the time. If we were sitting across a table from each other, I wouldn't see you as you are. I'd see you as you once were 2 billionths of a second ago. And you look marvelous over those 2 billionths
of
a second.
I'm sure I do.
That's small compared to your lifetime. But if you were very far away, then the light travel time becomes large relative to you and your life expectancy. So we see galaxies that would be very different today. We see stars that are no longer there, just the ghosts of their light that happen to still be traveling long after the star is gone.
And that is Neil deGrasse Tyson, our guest today on Radio Times. He's got a brand new book. It's called Starry Messenger, and it's subtitled Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. Some heady stuff here, also very timely as well. You can join our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can always call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you're just joining us, our guest is astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. We're talking about the importance of science, of rational thought, of evidence, of education in our highly polarized times. And he's got a brand new book called Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. He's director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Let me play another clip, and this is, I guess, Neil deGrasse Tyson's greatest hits. This is on The Late Show with James Corden back in 2016, when the host asked Neil deGrasse Tyson about using science as you raise your children, and he talks about the importance of using science when discussing the tooth fairy. Let's give it a quick listen.
At school, she got together with her friends and said, we think it might be our parents who are doing this.
Yeah.
If it is, whoever's tooth comes out at school, don't tell your parents. Put that tooth under the pillow and see what happens the next day. And it stayed a tooth. So they performed the experiment to demonstrate that the parents are the tooth fairy. And I'm thinking, this is how adults should behave. Okay? So, to distinguish fantasy from reality.
That's how adults should behave, Neil deGrasse Tyson. But we don't. Did we lose our guest?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry, sorry. Hey. That was just a very pregnant pause.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I think the inquiry is what is at the root of all learning, of course, and curiosity. And I just applaud that group of kids. And by the way, if you really think about it, if you haven't had kids, you might not realize that the Tooth Fairy story comes at exactly a time where the kids still believe the parents and don't really know enough about the world to doubt the parents. And so there's a gullibility there that is being exploited by this fantasy legend. And so if your kid is curious and wants to verify, that was just a brilliant solution to come up with it. And sure enough, that's the experiment that one should design, and they did.
You write in this book, to deny objective truth is to be scientifically illiterate, not to be ideologically principled. And I think we often can, and I will include myself in this, sort of beliefs, what we believe in and what is actually true or not. How do we wrestle with that?
Yeah, so if you need to distinguish, what I did in one of the chapters is called Truth and Beauty, where I sort of lay out this concept of truth. I didn't want to take ownership of the word truth, because many people use it in their own ways, especially religions. You look at sort of religious websites, the word truth is used persistently throughout. And so I wanted to make sure that that latitude was still there in my efforts to shape how people, I think, need to think about the word. So if you have certain religious beliefs, cultural beliefs, well, let's just call those personal truths. Mm-hmm. These are things that are true to you and you value them. But in a pluralistic country, where, by the way, your religious expression is constitutionally protected, your personal truth, to impart it on someone else who might have a different personal truth, would require some act of persuasion. And in the history of the world, in the limit, that has led to outright warfare leading to death. So wars based on conflict of personal truths, they never end well. All right, but in a country where we're all living together, where on one block you can get a mosque, a synagogue, and a church, we have to recognize and respect that people can have different personal truths without feeling the force of you requiring I agree with your personal truth, or if you rise to power and create legislation or laws based on your personal truth that then force others to comply. That's where you have the unraveling of a civil society. Another kind of truth would be like a political truth. That's where it just becomes true because you said it so much. Right? These are the seeds of propaganda. All right, and the brain is weak in this regard. If your brain, eye, brain, ear, sensory system, see something repeated many times, hear something, and you eventually say, it must be true if it's repeated that often. And like I said, that's what makes propaganda work. But on the other extreme, we have objective truths. And the methods and tools of science are exquisitely tuned to establish objective truths. And these are what is true, whether or not you believe in them. And that's, none of that is taught in school. So we're left as adults fending for ourselves, not really knowing the difference among those three.
Well, picking up on this reality, I guess, of that there is objective truth. How do you apply that to someone who believes in QAnon? How do you convince a follower that the Democrats, Hillary Clinton, are not leading a cabal of Satan-worshipping pedophiles? I think a lot of people listening saw the rally in Ohio where people following former President Donald Trump and putting their one finger in the air was a rather frightening image coming across. But how do you counter something where someone believes it so deeply in their core and it seems so patently obvious that it's not true?
Yeah, so that's a very important question. And again, I don't have this sort of silver bullet answer to that, but what I can say is there's an old saying, which I think is only like 85% true, that you can't use reason to argue someone out of a point of view that they didn't use reason to get into. Okay, I think there are exceptions to that, but it's mostly true. And so there are many people who are in that space right now. And so you need other tactics. You need to, and you can't just hit them on the head and tell them they're wrong. You have to percolate an idea up within them so that they can arrive at the conflict within themselves and say, oh my gosh, I've been seeing it the wrong way all along. And thank you for pointing me in that direction rather than thank you for hitting me on the head, because that, we have learned, never works. People just dig their heels in more strongly and put in less rational thought and then believe what they want to believe with all the more strength. And all I can say is maybe, like I said, I didn't have a silver bullet. Maybe we need more training in school, K through 12, about how to think about new information and how to apportion confidence in whether something is true or not. That's not there in school, and it ought to be.
Well, here's an email from Bill. What do you think about the idea of making a year-long course in critical thinking a requirement for all high school graduates? I mean, maybe we all need a course in critical thinking.
Yeah, no, that yes. However, there should be critical thinking taught every year of school. It should be, you know how you teach, there's English every year and it's math every year. There should be critical thinking every single year as applied to different topics, as applied to the internet, as applied to what people say, as applied to what your parents say, what politicians say, what authorities say. And you get to figure out what all of that means and how and why. And yes, I'm agreeing with your emailer. Yes.
Well, I'm also thinking of how, and I think this is a very human thing to do, is we seek out knowledge that reinforces what we believe anyway, confirmation bias. It makes us feel like we're smart and we're right, and then we're on the right path. How do we counter that?
So nothing feeds confirmation bias the way a Google search does.
Exactly. It's designed that way.
If you think Earth is hollow instead of flat or round or whatever, you can type in hollow Earth and it'll take you to every website and every blog that ever was a proponent of a hollow Earth, leaving you with the impression that you're onto something. And we also have this odd urge where if someone comes up and says, everyone has been thinking this way all along and they're wrong, here's the real answer. Somehow we give that person vastly more attention and we invest much more belief in what that person says than the masses. Now, of course, there have been lone truth seekers and tellers in the past, sure. But just because everyone disagrees with you, it doesn't mean you're correct. just think that through, right? So it's the training in how to think about what role evidence plays in how you apportion your belief. That's all it comes down to.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you, and that's Neil deGrasse Tyson, a familiar voice as the host of the podcast Star Talk. He's also the director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History, and he's got a new book we've been talking about. It's called Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. And again, you can always join our conversation. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, and you can always pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Well, I'm quoting you again, Neil deGrasse Tyson. This is from your book where you say, of all the professions, scientists may be uniquely capable of generating and sustaining peace among nations. Defend that, if you would.
Oh, sure. So I'll just give an example. Do you remember a couple of years ago, there was the first ever photograph of a black hole in the center of a galaxy?
Yeah.
And it was banner headlines all around. And if you unpack that story, what you learn is that this image was the collaboration of like 100 telescopes around the world and hundreds of scientists of all nationalities coming together to create this one result. Scientists know, first of all, that if I get into an argument with another scientist, usually it's almost all cases, it's because there's not enough data yet to distinguish one case from another. So we're making our case. If I enter an argument, either There's the unwritten contract that I possess walking into that argument. And that contract says either I'm wrong and you're right, or you're wrong and I'm right, or we're both wrong.
Hmm.
And that is, I don't know any other arguing people who think that way when they're having that conversation. And so so there's not only this ethos that goes on among scientists, but keep in mind that when I calculate with the value of pi, that value is the same no matter what side of any border crossing I'm on, right? So mathematics is literally universal. And when I say universal, I don't mean just earthwide. I mean across the universe. So scientists all speak the same language as each other. And that also has value for a peace and harmony. But further, just imagine you're with other scientists out in space doing some experiments, and back on Earth, the countries are not getting along, and then they pull their representatives out of the embassies, and they're at the brink of war, and you're out in space doing a science experiment. Are you supposed to just, drop the lab experiment and get in a fist fight with your foreign fellows? That's not going to happen. You know this, okay? And of course, it depends on the depth of your allegiance to your leader. But at some level, the scientist is going to do this. They're going to do their experiment regardless of the geopolitical immaturities that are unfolding on Earth's surface. So I don't know any other profession that has that capability. And even the International Space Station, it's one of the greatest collaborations of nations there ever was. Okay, you have the World Cup, sure, the Olympics. The International Space Station is a more expensive collaboration than those.
Hmm.
Okay, and by the way, the most expensive international collaboration is the waging of war. Okay, Axis powers fighting the all right. That's the most expensive collaboration of nations, but that ends up in death and bloodshed. The World Cup and the Olympics are still people competing with each other, okay? Scientists collaborating, there it is. It's in our DNA to be friendly to other people who are also doing science, and that's the source of that sentence. Sorry, it took me 5 minutes to communicate that.
Well, but, yeah. And I want to actually ask you then an earthbound question, because we know that German scientists created death camps, that German physicians did inhumane experiments. I could go on and on. That on Earth, yes, in the potential for good and peace is there, but it has been also used for not just nefarious things, but really evil things as well.
Yeah, that's a very important point, and thanks for bringing it up. Most science that is published during outright warfare, I don't say most science, but very important science that either does not get published because it's kept secret, or even does get published, is in the service of war. Okay, war is a huge driver in the investment of scientific advances. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll give the simplest example. All right, how do you know which route to return to grandma's house? Because GPS tells you how to avoid the traffic, or how do you if you're using Tinder, okay, how do you find a mate within 300 yards of where you're standing? All right. This is a technology and a capability invented by the U.S. Air Force in the service of the U.S. military. So there is a huge two-way street overlap between scientific advances and war. The point I should have made and did not, which you aptly brought up, is yes, scientists are tapped in the service of warfare. Galileo, when he perfected the telescope, before he looked up at the night sky, he took it to the Doge of Venice, to the clock tower in Venice, and they looked at it. He said, look at the ships in the lagoon. You can now identify. You can see their flags and identify whether they're friend or foe 10 times farther away than you can with the unaided eye.
Hmm.
Then the Doge went up and bought a bunch of telescopes from him, and Galileo was financially secure to then just look up in the sky and publish a book on it. So this goes way back. My point is, scientists rarely, if ever, wield the resources to themselves wage war. They're the pawns of disagreeing geopolitical systems. And if you remove the geopolitical system, I have very serious doubt that they would still want to storm the hill, that they would still want to create instruments of destruction. I don't see that. Even Wernher von Braun, the mastermind behind the V2 rocket, which terrorized London, you know what he said of the V2 rocket? By the way, that's the first thing we ever launched that left the atmosphere. So everybody knew these are the seeds of a future of space exploration. He said, yes, the V2 was successful. The problem is it landed on the wrong planet. Okay, so this is his heart speaking, distinct from his commands from Hitler to terrorize Germany and wherever else he aimed his rockets. So, yes, I didn't mean to claim scientists have
pure
noses. Right. But we're not, you will not find legions of armies being led by scientists to storm a hill. That's not going to happen.
We're almost having a break here. Should we have more scientists in government then?
Oh, well, yes. I don't want to scream at you here. But, you know, you look at government, it's at least half people who are trained at law. Now, granted, we call them lawmakers, so that sounds right on the surface. But lawyers, in my experience, are trained arguers, right? That's what they do. They'll argue whether or not they are in the right because someone paid them to take a position for a case that they are arguing. Now you fold on top of that politics, okay, which is a fundamentally argue place, right, is in politics. So you have the double whammy of a lawyer who likes to argue in a system where you can only resolve things by arguing, and then nothing gets done. And so I'm just thinking you have a mixture of other kinds of people there. You know there's an objective truth out there.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's got a new book, Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. He has spent a career studying the stars, space, our place in the universe. As you can tell, he's a passionate spokesman for the value of science, evidence, and rational thought. And again, he's got a new book called Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on the Universe, where he argues that scientific inquiry can actually bridge some of our conflicts and lead to greater understanding. Let me read this email from Peter. He says, I disagree that scientific facts are so clearly separated from less certain hypotheses. As I understand it, scientific claims are continually under examination. I think the process by which a hypothesis becomes a quote fact eventually becomes largely psychological, that we acclimate ourselves to it. That's a really interesting point from Peter. What do you say?
Yes, a very important point. So if you eavesdrop on the scientific conferences, it's every idea is getting contested at all times. That's the point of the conference. The difference is the ideas being contested are on the frontier of thought and at the limits of experimental accuracy. And so often conferences, conflicts resolve because people then agree after they go out and have a beer that a new kind of data set needs to be established or a new kind of observation needs to be obtained. And so that's an important reality. And once that's done, once a result is repeated, not just from one person, but someone who's your competitor, someone who's from another country, and you get a consistency of scientific reporting, then you have discovered a new objective truth. And so that's why I distinguish objective truths of science from all the other kinds of truths. So E equals MC squared is not a property of whether you believe in it or not. All right, that will happen, and it's the foundation of all atomic energy and the bombs and everything. So we're not here debating that. That is real. There are objective truths in this world. That is one of the remarkable discoveries that science has made. It's not all just magic or belief systems. We should celebrate that fact.
part of the problem, and you talked several times about social media, is that I think for a lot of people, they actually prefer TikTok to the National Science Foundation or NOAA or NASA or you, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Yeah, I mean, someone on TikTok says, this is how you do it. Everyone else has been doing it wrong. They're keying into some urge we have where we embrace the testimony of an individual above the reality of statistics. There's an entire chapter on risk and reward where I lament the fact that our brain is not wired to think about the world statistically or probabilistically. And the saddest sentence I wrote was to say that entire industries have arisen to exploit that shortcoming of the human mind, and they're called casinos. There you are, betting on a 7 in the roulette table. I say, why are you doing that? Well, 7 is due because it hasn't come up in 10 roll or whatever. And I say, no, it is not due. It's the same probability every single time. But you don't want to believe it because it doesn't feel right. This is a gap in our capacity to interpret reality. And the book completely explores examples from all facets of our society where our thinking is incomplete, but we believe it to be complete and then act on it.
Hmm.
And that's the unraveling of an informed civilization.
Well, and you say us human beings are limited because we generally think in linear terms, correct?
Yes. We think, okay, if it happened this way in 2 days, it'll happen this other way in 4 days. There are some things in our world that happen exponentially, like the spread of a virus, for example. If you say, oh, the virus has only hit 100 people today, and since yesterday, it'll be 100 people tomorrow. No, it'll be 1,000 people tomorrow, then 10,000 people the next day. And here we are not understanding. This is the mathematics of it all.
Sure.
You know, I was going to tweet. I think I did tweet once. I said, I think state lotteries are a tax on all those people who never did well in mathematics, right, in school. I mean, it's a little snarky, but I think it's kind of true. And so I try to highlight places where the thinking has gone astray, and then we anchor it in a new place, a place of science literacy, and in some cases, a place of cosmic wisdom, where, oh my gosh, it's a new place to stand, a new vista. And now you look at what you used to be fighting about and say, oh my gosh, there was never any argument there to begin with. I have a quick example drawn from the meat eaters and vegetarians chapter, because each chapter is places where people fight, right? And one of them is, let's say you're a vegetarian because you don't want to kill animals, okay? No one's going to take that from you, all right? You even have a humane mouse trap in your basement. It traps the mouse without snapping its neck. You go down there, you say, oh, there's the mouse, and then you put it back out in the wild, where it is guaranteed to be eaten by an owl, a hawk, or crows, all manner of woodland predators. Foxes will eat the mouse. The average life expectancy of a mouse in the wild is between 9 and 18 months. So the safest thing you could do for that mouse is leave it in your basement. It'll live 6 years in the warmth and comfort of your basement. And so to say I care about the life of animals, you're making a decision that has doomed the mouse to an early death. I point this out because you can still do it, but be fully informed as much as science can provide for you before you make those decisions. And the more people are fully informed, I think the more rational the world will be, even when we formulate our opinions.
Well, let me go back to a tweet that you sent out. This was back in August of 2019. It was after one of these horrible mass shootings in El Paso and in Dayton. I think more than 30 people were killed. And you tweeted shortly after these mass shootings, on average across any 48 hours, we also lose 500 to medical errors, 300 to flu, 250 to suicide, 200 to car accidents, 4 to homicide via handgun. You did apologize for that, but I think it's where facts have to sort of meet the moment when people are willing to engage and entertain those ideas, rather than when they're still reeling from the fact that, you know, children are getting mowed down in a public school somewhere.
Yeah, so I think I began that tweet by saying that the shooting was tragic.
You did.
Okay.
Horrifically lost 34 people to mass shootings. You did. Correct.
Okay, so, and then I went on to compare the death toll of that shooting to other things that happen every single day. And what I apologize for was not knowing, as an educator, I care how people receive information, because that once I know that, I can improve how I communicate. I'm not there to anger people or piss people off. But what happened was everybody roiled. They
jumped on you.
It was a complete it was a complete attack. And then so what has happened is so I apologize for the bluntness of it, okay? But I can't apologize for communicating facts. And the day we live in a world where someone is afraid to tell you what is true, and they only tell you what you want to hear. This is why politicians lie. We blame politicians for lying. You know why they lie? Because they tell you what you want to hear. If they ever told you what you should hear, you would never vote them into office. So I don't blame politicians. I blame us, the electorate. So all that being said, yes, there are ways to be sensitive to those who have lost loved ones, and in ways that tweet was not. Mm-hmm. That was very blunt in the numbers that were communicated. But what I said was that we react more to singular tragedies than to the statistics of what's actually going on out there. And I think that needs to be addressed at some level.
Here's a tweet from John who says, scientists should not hold back from commenting on politics. These topics are in our wheelhouse. You had mentioned, you know, the pandemic. We are dealing with, you know, viruses that are spreading around the world. We've got climate change right before our eyes. It seems that we need science more than ever to help us solve some of these problems. Do we have the tools and the wherewithal to do that?
Yeah, of course, because more and more science issues are fundamental to the survival of civilization. And not just the survival, but will we not just survive, but thrive? All right. And so many of those come from scientific foundations. And to deny a scientist even a comment, if not an opinion, on what is going on politically is to somehow to disenfranchise those who may know best what the consequences are of what it is they might have researched or created in the laboratory. So I wouldn't say give them all the seats at the table, but they should have some seats at the table that can, so that, and you have to know how to listen to a scientist, right? A scientist will never give any statement with certainty because there's always a statistical couching of the data. You need to understand how and why that's done, okay? And so, this is a challenge. And I think that the extent to which science is ignored is, like I said, it's the beginning of the end of an informed democracy.
Do you think we're there, or have we learned? I mean, it seems that people now, maybe because it's right in front of our eyes, we're seeing what's happening in Puerto Rico, for instance, that we are seeing climate change. And so now we have to figure out how to do something about it. The question is whether we're too late or not. But nonetheless, here we are.
We lost at least 10 or 20 years arguing with climate science deniers about the reality of human-induced climate change. And over that time, the warring factions, the conservatives and liberals, could have been debating geopolitical, cultural, political solutions to that reality. And the political, and what is it? Is it carbon tax? Is it tariffs? Do you supplement solar panels? Do you promote electric vehicles? These all have political solutions. And the more you delay a political conversation about in a solution to an objective reality, the more you're at risk of that reality completely taking out everything you are and what your grid is. And yeah, the intensity of storms, the extremes we're seeing, they're, you know, the once in a century floods are now once a decade, for example. I hear people say, oh, we've had a flood 100 years ago. And we had one 3 years ago and now, but it's happened before. No, you just had two in a decade. All right. Do we understand the statistics of this? Let's get real here.
You describe a country you would like to create called Rationalia. Do I have that right?
Yeah, Rationalia.
Rationalia, yeah. Which I think is, if people have been listening for the full hour, get what it would be about, which would be about evidence and data and facts and education. You even have a constitution for rationalia.
Yeah, the constitution is you can't pass a law unless you have evidence in support of the goal of that law. And by the way, so then you debate whether you want the law at all. But if everyone agrees we should have a law because it achieves some outcome, you should have evidence based for whether or not you would agree to have that law seek that outcome. Without it, you don't have a law. So it's a completely evidence based governance. And it's an interesting variant on what we currently have, where people base laws on feelings, on their own personal truths, which we discussed earlier in the show. And if we're going to preserve the plurality of who and what we are as a country, which I celebrate, by the way, you know, why is it that on Twitter, if you express an opinion on anything, you get attacked? Mm. You don't, people don't say, oh, that's interesting, here's my opinion. That's not what happens. It's you idiot, or you this, or you're that, or you cretin, or you're whatever. And I'm thinking, in the limit of that, do you really want everyone else to have your exact opinion? We have a word for those countries. They're called dictatorships, okay? Everybody, it's groupthink. I don't want that. I want to celebrate the diversity of people's thoughts and feelings. I just want your thoughts and feelings to be to be as informed as possible. And the best way to inform them is to see what science has said about it and what a cosmic perspective might bring. Without it, I think we're just wandering off. You know, we might as well regress to a time when all things happen by magical forces, and you wished that they would happen one way versus another. And if not, there was some spirit energy that prevented it. You know, there's some people today who still worry when Mercury goes into retrograde, which is a highly regressive thought, dating from when we thought we were in the center of all motion. And there's Mercury going around Earth, and then it slows down, stops, and goes backwards. Oh my gosh, that's got to portend doom. We still have people today who believe that portends doom, in total disregard for 1,000 years of science, 600 years of science that says otherwise. That's a problem, especially if you rise to power and create laws.
We have about a minute before I have to say goodbye. I just have a quick question about Mars, since you are an astrophysicist, and we're getting this NASA rover Perseverance has collected some samples of two rocks that apparently have some carbon-based molecules in them. What do you think that portends? What do you think that means?
I'm loving it. Well, carbon is common in the universe, so we shouldn't be surprised that on another planet we find carbon. But what's fun about this SUV-sized rover plunked down on Mars, which, by the way, also had a helicopter, the first airborne object ever on another place other than Earth, that will collect these samples, and those samples will wait for a sample return mission. Okay, so we got a whole daisy chain here of analysis that will unfold. So yeah, it's hand picking. It's machine picking the rocks that will have the greatest chance of giving us some insight into the history of Mars and whether it ever harbored life. Because we know it once had water coursing over its surface. And every place we have water on Earth, there's life, including the Red Sea. They just didn't have microscopes to see the microbes. The Red Sea is salty enough they did not have vertebrate fishes. So they said it was dead because they didn't have science, basically.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, we got to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks you for your continued interest.
Absolutely. And the book is titled Starry Messenger, Cosmic Perspectives on Civilization. And Neil deGrasse Tyson will be at the Kimmel Cultural Campus this Friday here in Philadelphia. To replay this hour, many more hours of Radio Times, go to WHYY.org and look for Radio Times Center programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.